Hey, it's Joe. Mitochondria. It's the hot topic, all right, but why? Everyone has heard the analogies about VO2 max being the size of your engine, or an empty fuel tank being like depleted muscle glycogen. But what no one talks about is the fuel injector system, or carburetors for us old guys. Mitochondria. Yours, mine, everyone's mitochondria, via the electron transport chain, are nature's original fuel injectors working to combine just the right amount of fuel and oxygen for whatever power output you need in the moment. Too little fuel, you get poor performance, sputtering, loss of power. Too much fuel flooding the system, you get wasted gas, incomplete combustion, carburetor buildup, harmful exhaust, maybe even a little fire under the hood. Ever hear about reactive oxygen species and free radicals? Yeah. But here's the thing. Your electron transport chain in your mitochondria can fail in many different ways. Maybe you're missing key nutrients. Maybe your membranes are damaged. Maybe you've got very efficient but too few mitochondria. Maybe you've got lots of old sloppy mitochondria spewing out reactive oxygen species like an engine with bad rings dumping oil smoke. The problem is you, me, everyone, we're flying blind. We're trying every supplement, every training protocol, every recovery hack that worked for someone else, without understanding what do we as an individual need. Well, today we're going to change that. Today I'm talking with Dr. Hemal Patel of the University of California at San Diego, who is the creator of the MeScreen mitochondrial assessment developed for NASA. The point is to learn how to diagnose your own cellular fuel injection system, to identify your own specific bottlenecks and address the root causes. Because at the end of the day, it's not about training harder, at least not at our age. It's about training smarter. All right, let's talk to Dr. Patel. Dr. Hemal Patel, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Good to see you, Joe.
Hey, I appreciate you making some time for me. As a mitochondrial researcher, I have a lot of questions for you, and I think you have the answers that I'm looking for. So thank you for taking some time for us.
So
before we jump into the mitochondrial weeds here, can you give our audience a bit on your background and also tell us a little bit about this test that you developed? Where did that come from?
So I'm a professor, tenured professor at the University of California, San Diego. I've been here about 23 years now. I got my PhD at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. My thesis focused on how to protect the heart from ischemic injury. And this is an energy problem, right? And so I started thinking about mitochondrial energetics very young in my scientific career. And we've sort of stuck with that as the running theme of my lab as we've come through and created our own stuff as well. So after my PhD, the focus was really how does this organ that ages and dies, how do you protect that from a heart attack, which is one of the biggest things we deal with? Mm-hmm. And there are sort of two competing ideas in this. One was at the time, well, let's just grow stem cells and just populate this tissue with new cells. And so if the old ones are dead, we can get new ones. Turns out you have to put a lot of new cells into there to salvage that tissue and that muscle to make it perform. So the other thing that we were focused on is when the heart does undergo injury during a heart attack, are there endogenous pathways that get activated that then protect it? And if we could understand these endogenous pathways, could we come up with outside treatments, exogenous things that we could do to create this? And so my PhD focused on the role of opioids in protecting the heart. And it turns out that anything that's a little bit of a toxin creates a huge protective effect, right? What Nietzsche said, that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Oh. And so this notion of a little bit of stress is a good thing. And it turns out that one of the things that these preconditioning or protective agents do is that they create a mild stressor that then causes this dramatic change in how the heart handles energy. And what most people don't know is that the heart really dies when you reperfuse it, when you give it all of that oxygen and nutrients back. During that ischemic attack, when you're basically having a heart attack, you're depriving that organ of blood and nutrients, and it goes into a stasis, right? Almost like this hibernating like thing where all of your energy mechanisms and things stop. Then when you put that blood back into that tissue, the heart doesn't know what to do with all of that nutrient and all of that oxygen. And what it actually does is it creates injury. It creates free radicals, which then cause damage, which then is this rapid cycle of this thing that you can't control, and you get massive injury. And so our goal was to figure out ways to protect that. When I moved to UCSD, the focus shifted slightly. One of the things that I've always been interested in as a scientist is I want to dabble in all of the areas of biology so that when I do start my own lab, I can just ask all these far out questions and just answer them. And so I became a very strong physiologist in my PhD work. And so I was missing the cell biology component. And so my initial work at UCSD was really to become a hardcore cell biologist, to understand all the nitty gritty of the basic unit of life and how we could control elements of that. And my postdoc work really focused on the membrane. And this is an often ignored part of a cell that no one really gives much importance. If you think about it, we're going to talk a lot about longevity today. There's all these hallmarks of longevity that people talk about. I've seen lists that number into the 9 to 11 kinds of things. And it always irks me when I look at this list and I don't see the membrane come up as any feature of that. It is probably the most important aspect of a living organism is the barrier you create that limits the outside from the inside, right? This is how you age well. If you can limit those two environments, you create a barrier that creates this toxin-free environment and you get resilience and you live forever. The most long-lived organism on planet Earth is a giant clam. The reason why it lives so long, it has this hard shell that prevents the outside from the inside. It wasn't until some guy wanted to see what was inside that he killed it, right? I mean, these things live the 500 years kinds of things. And so this really became this conduit. And because we can't study the membrane in a fine detail in easy kinds of ways, energy becomes the second conduit, right? And so a lot of the things that our lab focused on was how does the membrane regulate energetics in a cell? And is there a relationship between the membrane biology and mitochondria and how that fixates? And we actually hit upon this interesting observation that there are not all membranes are created the same, that there are these unique platforms that create a signaling entity within a cell and they create efficiency. And as we get older, these structures start to fall apart. And it turns out that if you can make more of these structures, they stabilize energy in a cell, right? They make your mitochondria perfect and pristine, and they allow you to adapt in a dramatic kind of way with age and other things. And this is something we've been chasing now for many, many years. We just found out last week that one of our patents that was picked up with collaborators at UCSD that have been working on this for decades now, it seems like, the FDA just cleared to move into an IND in humans as a first-in-man therapeutic for ALS. And it all targets the membrane, right? This idea that the membrane regulates energetics in a disease phenotype. So it's been an exciting journey to do all this, and we've sort of traversed this in many different ways. And we're going to get to this in a second, but I think one of the biggest barriers in this space has been, well, how do you know your mitochondria are working or not working? And when you talk to physicians, mostly in the functional medicine space, their response is, well, we just ask people if they feel better, which seems like a really silly way of knowing if your mitochondria are working, right? You go on all these crazy supplements that cost you thousands of dollars, or you do these fangled treatments with red light, sauna, hyperbaric chambers, and all these things that thousands of dollars you spend in this. And then the only way to know if those are actually working is to ask you if you feel better, right? And so we wanted to come up with a way to objectively measure how your mitochondria are doing. That's where MeScreen comes in.
Well, that's amazing. That is exactly what I want to talk about. I have to say that as I've been preparing for our talk and I've been listening to your earlier talks, I have been surprised to learn that I have long thought that a lack of energy was a cause of failure in lots of organs of the body, right? I have brain fog. Well, why is that? Well, I have low energy in my brain cells and they're not able to function properly. And what you have taught me is that it's really two things. It's, yeah, there's an energy production issue, but there's also energy is made with oxygen, and oxygen is damaging. And so there's two things happening. There's the energy enough or not enough. And then there's the excess oxygen or the waste product of the combustion engine, the mitochondria making energy that we use to power all of our cells. Are they making a lot of waste products that are going on and damaging our body. And so it's there's a lot going on there in that little tiny mitochondria, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, it's little tiny, but there's trillions of these in our bodies, right? And so it all accumulates. And so it is this double-edged sword. One of the things that is the toxic byproduct of mitochondrial respiration and this handling of what we call molecular fire, right? You're basically moving oxygen through the system, and it has the potential to create this fire, which is a free radical, or these reactive oxygen species, superoxide, hydroxyl radicals, if it reacts with nitric oxide to make peroxynitrite. All of these things are damaging to lipids, DNA, proteins, RNA, all the things that are the stuff of our cells that we need to function in the right way. But at the same time, those reactive species not only create damage, but they also signal, right? One of the big things when I was getting my PhD, every scientist was wearing a shirt called "What Part of NO Don't You Understand?" And this was when nitric oxide was discovered.
Right.
And so this is this free radical that has this huge signaling potential. This is what drugs like Viagra and other things are built off of. It's a nitric oxide producing kind of thing, right? It's these cyclic GMP inhibitors. And so this really became at the forefront that maybe these toxic radicals have a potential to signal. We'd sort of explored this idea of carbon monoxide, which we think is a bad thing, and sort of those things. If you, and this goes back to my PhD, that a little bit of a stressor may be protective. So maybe smoking one cigarette a day could be a protective thing because you're creating these free radicals and other things. Mm-hmm. Not saying that that's something you should go and test out and do, but there is this notion that a little bit of stress can create this resiliency in our systems because our systems need that to adapt, right, long term.
Yeah.
And so there is evidence to suggest that these tiny micro stressors then create a small burst of free radicals that then create a signaling pool, right? And it's this signaling that's critical to this. And we've shown this in some of the hard work in the papers we've published in the past, that these free radicals are really a trigger for the protective response to happen. The other aspect, there's a lot of papers coming out, a lot of thought around this, that you actually need your mitochondria to fall asleep. And a trigger for this may be some component of these free radicals that get generated that then allow you to go into this resting state as well. So I think it's an open book right now to try to figure out what's actually happening with these and how free radicals are involved. But there is a relationship, right? And it's not a simple, easy up or down kind of thing. It's probably both.
Yeah. It's always more complicated than you think. And every time you get a better microscope and you can see a little further, it's like a whole new universe underneath there.
Yeah.
But still, we do know some things just from trial and error. You know, athletes have developed training protocols that work. You know, maybe we're not sure exactly why, but we do know that they work. But this idea of being able to measure directly your mitochondria, if mitochondria are sort of like the, let's just say for now, it's the lowest common denominator, right? It's the smallest thing that is having this biggest effect. That is new information. Anyway, I do want to get more into that. I want to transition now, maybe not into the deep science, the hard science, the math involved in the science, but rather, what is it that mitochondria do for us? And why would an older athlete be especially concerned about his or her mitochondria? And I'll speak for myself and say that when I started this podcast, it was all about sort of athletic performance and training and how to get stronger and faster. And very quickly, it turned out that being a healthy person is the most important thing to being a good athlete. But I don't think that there's anything inconsistent between what I would need to do for my mitochondria to be a healthy human being that could have a long life and a long, healthy life, and what I need to do that makes me a strong athlete for as long as possible. I think that these are consistent things, and I'm want to get into that, which is like maybe higher level stuff. But if you could just tell us, what is the mitochondria doing for us? And it's not just in human beings, it's like in everything, because it started billions of years ago. And how do we know that it's happening? I take longer to recover, you know, things like that. And are there things that we can do? I mean, why does it happen? Are there things we can do to reverse it, or, you know, signal to my body these signals you're talking about? Can I signal to my body, hey, do this is what I need you to do, Mr. Mitochondria, and it will listen to, if I speak the right language, it will listen to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a historical question, right? It brings us to where we are today. So back when life started, right? And this is something that we've pondered and thought about, is where did it sort of begin? And it was this idea of this primordial soup of just stuff around. And so in order for life to start, you had to coalesce it. And this is where membranes come into focus, right? Until you had a membrane that limited something in a very tight space, you couldn't get the chemical reactions to happen to create life and propagating to the next level. And so the first cell was probably this very rudimentary thing that was probably the nucleus, is what we think of, right? Is this first cell, this thing that had some genetic information. And, you know, Nobel Prizes have been awarded for this. The big conundrum was the chicken and egg thing. If you need a protein to make DNA, how do you get those? Because the proteins come from DNA. And so the solution to this, Tom Cech proposed, was that there was a thing called a ribozyme. It was a combination of a nucleic acid material, and it was a combination of an enzyme. And this gave rise to what we know as modern DNA and protein. And then this RNA was this intermediary structure, right? The cookbook versus the recipe, which is your RNA, cookbook is your DNA. And then the bread you make out of that is the protein and the business end of things that happen. And so this first life had this component. It was doing very rudimentary biochemistry to survive, right? And one of the first likely reactions that created energy was glycolysis. You were breaking down glucose to make energy. It was fast, not super efficient. You made a couple molecules of ATP, and that kicked the can down the road and allowed you to divide and do the things you needed to do. And then, people think of this as happen chance. There's some event back in the way, way distant past. A bacteria got together with the cell and they incorporated, right? And so this was the start of this symbiotic relationship, which is what they think is the origin of mitochondria and chloroplasts in plants, and the combination of the two as these two large organisms evolve, plants and animals. This incorporation, these bacteria that got incorporated, needed a place to live. And so the cell and the plant cell provided that environment for them to live. And then they have to give it something in order for it to be a symbiosis. And so what they gave was this supercharged energy. Now for breaking down a single molecule of glucose, instead of making 2 ATP, you're making 36 ATP molecules, right? Very so nice. You have a lot more energy to then start creating more cells and more complexity and organization and division and organs and an entire organism that has heads and feet and arms and all these things, right? And so that
it can run fast.
All of that is driven by energy. And it goes back to this oxygen hypothesis as well, right? So one of the other things the lab is very interested in is the adaptations that happen in the membrane that allowed for growth. If you look, one of the biggest adaptations in the membrane that allowed for our movement from water to a terrestrial environment, which is oxygen rich, was the inclusion of cholesterol in the plasma membrane, right? Cholesterol becomes this key molecule that allows us to grow. And in my talks, I show this cartoon that was, I don't know where it was published, but basically it's a fish that's sitting in the water, and it's this thing that's moved into the terrestrial space. And the fish in the water is saying, hey, better, your doctor says that air breathing may be the death of you. And that fish in the water, outside of the water, this terrestrial thing, says, don't worry, my doctor says I have high cholesterol, right? This idea that cholesterol becomes this conduit for adapting to this mega environment. One of the things we've discovered in the lab is that these cholesterol-rich microdomains of the plasma membrane sit in very close proximity to mitochondria. And so they create this relationship between, we think, how oxygen is delivered to the cell and how oxygen is then ultimately utilized. And this is one of the things that we've been fascinated with looking from an aging perspective, is this dynamic becomes really important. As you get older, your membranes is what I think really start to fall apart. And so now this barrier, this cholesterol that was binding oxygen and keeping it from flooding into your cell, no longer exists, and you're starting to flood the system. And now the mitochondria are having an overabundance of oxygen. So in addition to being sort of coupled and making energy at the end of the day, they have an abundance where there's a more higher chance that they're going to shoot off free radicals and other things that then cause damage as well. And this, I think, is the conundrum of aging, right? This demise of the plasma membrane, which leads to a falling apart of energetic systems. And so the question becomes, how do you manage all this? And so the mitochondria become a core force of this. They allow for all of the crazy complexity and the energy demands that our bodies need, which are very complicated. A typical example, go back to the heart. If you look at the heart under an electron microscope, where you can look at thousands of X magnification, it is packed with mitochondria. 30% of the volume of the cell and of the heart is mitochondria. You make about 4 kilograms of ATP a day, yet you don't gain 4 kilograms because you're constantly making it and using it, right? Your heart's constantly beating. If it stops beating and that energy production stops, you die, right? It's an easy calculus to understand. So the mitochondria become a key feature of this. There's 30% of that volume of that tissue, that organ is generating that energy to keep it going for the rest of your life. And so you can see very quickly how if you start messing with the energy balance in that heart, you can get heart failure, you can get diabetic cardiomyopathy, you can get all these things that lead to hyperaging and dysfunction and ultimately morbidity, mortality kind of thing. So the question becomes, how do you stabilize this? How do you make it better? One of the things that doctors will tell you is exercise is great for you, which is true. I was at a conference in DC once, and I had a couple hours to kill before I had to get on a flight. And I was rummaging through a bookstore in Bethesda, and I happened upon this book. And I wish I could have remembered the title, and I've got to do a Google search. I'm sure AI will find it for me in a second. But it basically calculated how much life you would have if you sat on a couch and did nothing your whole life, just was a couch potato, versus what you would lose if you started exercising. Because exercising is some element of slow death, right? Because you're getting stimulation of adrenergic response. You're releasing these catecholamines, which have this capability of increasing your heart rate, and all these things create some sort of stressors in our system. And I think it came out to like 2 years is all you came by exercise. So the question is, why exercise? And you just sit on the couch and do nothing and die 2 years earlier, but enjoy your life eating garbagey foods and things like that. Not that that's the way you should do it, but there has always been this question of what is the value of exercise and does it give you a true longevity? And so I think one of the things I think about is there a right way to exercise? And these questions have come up, right? Is there a right
way in terms of living longer, help more healthily?
Yeah, like healthy kinds of things. And okay. I was on a thesis committee for a student a few years back. And one of the early questions he was asking is there a right time of day to exercise? And people think, you know, depending on one thing or other you've read, is morning better? Is afternoon better? Is evening better? And some of the work he did in model species and things suggests that there really is no opportune, perfect time to exercise. It's whatever you feel works well for you kind of thing, right? But then the question becomes, is there a right type of exercise? I interact with a lot of biohackers with this mitochondrial test we've had. And I can tell you some of the worst mitochondria we see are in biohackers. They're overhacking their mitochondria. They're overstimulating them, overdoing things. And this is one of the things we see is that there is so much as overdoing the exercise kind of thing. So I think you have to find what's optimal for your body, what you can tolerate, and then really see how this is optimizing your ability. I think there's lots of evidence to suggest that slow burn kinds of things are good, right? These walks that aren't easy cake, but aren't full on cardiometabolic stress that you're creating in that system, are likely going to create lots of resiliency. People have done studies where they take sedentary individuals and just make them stand up at their desk once a day. And you see dramatic changes in their cardiometabolic health. And it's just an action of breaking up monotony of just sitting there and letting your body sit stasis, right? The act of just getting up creates this drive and a change in your heart rate and other things. So it really, I think, is simple. You don't have to overdo it and overhack yourself to get to this endpoint. I think it is finding what works well for your body, what you can tolerate, and then pushing your body to that end, right? One of the things that, you know, a lot of my friends will jokingly say is that, well, health is easy. You just have to eat right, sleep right, and move right. Those are the three hardest things in the world to do, I think, at least for me.
Oh, yeah. People just say, give me a pill.
I know. And maybe eventually we'll get to that stage. I don't know. Lifestyle changes are hard. One of the things I show a slide in some talks I give, and it breaks down aspects of your health, right? and who defines health as this complete sort of aspect of social, mental, emotional well-being, and not just this absence of disease. And one of the things it breaks down is that if a physician is almost 100% right, they will only make 20% impact on your particular health process, right? Hmm. This suggests that the 80% of your health really comes from who you are and what your behaviors are.
I believe that.
What you choose to do really determines your health. Someone can tell you to the blue in the face, but unless you actually put that into practice and actually do what's supposed to be done for optimally for your body, it's a hard sort of premise to keep going. Right? The other thing is, I think why most diets and most exercise plans and most sleep things fail is that we're very good at doing things for a short amount of time, right? We get scared into it. I went through the same thing. So my mother died very young. She was 60, died in her sleep. And it was very jarring and traumatic for me. The other scientific sadness that I experienced was I was looking at ways to protect the heart from ischemic injury, and she died of a heart attack. And she died because she was a type 2 diabetic and had all this dysfunction. And so I scratched my head. It's like, I'm supposed to be the one that's finding the path forward in all this space, and I couldn't. And so that really changed my health behaviors for about a year and a half. I would go to the YMCA every day, you know, lift weights, do cardio, did the whole regimen. Felt amazing. And you would think that feeling of amazement would continue to keep going and last long term. Life catches up with you, you forget about that trauma, and you move to the next thing, and life changes, right? Your behaviors change in a dramatic kind of way. I think this is the key to longevity and living well, is to create a routine that's healthy and maintain it for that lifetime, right? And it's, I think one of the things that your listeners and other people, hopefully the ones that do well, realize that it's not easy, right? If you want to live forever, it's not a pill, right? It's something that you're going to have to work hard at and really be focused in doing.
Yeah.
And so this is something that we've been thinking about, from how do we give people the tools to now know, right, whether they're on a trajectory. And not, it's not that the goal is to scare them into getting back on that two-week regimen, but if you could track a vital that's never been there, right? And one of these vitals is mitochondrial functionality.
Right.
Everyone talks about it. There's so many drugs on the market right now that target mitochondria, so many supplements. There's so many devices that people are marketing as ways to supercharge your mitochondria. Yet again, when you're asked, well, how do you know your mitochondria? Well, I just feel better, right? And so the question is, can we give an objective number to this? And so the best way to do this is to get a muscle biopsy. Who wants to do that?
Ouch.
Right? You got to go in typically to a research center. It'd be thousands of dollars to even get at this. Most of these are not commercial. You have to be part of a research study. They numb your leg up. They take this gigantic needle, plunge it into that numb leg, pull it out. A little bit of a couple hundred milligrams of muscle comes out. That then comes to a lab like mine. And then we spend the next 6 to 8 hours analyzing the functionality of that mitochondria in excruciating detail. It gives you an amazing window into what your mitochondria are doing. We've done hundreds of these on campus as parts of different clinical trials. We were involved in a Gulf War illness clinical trial. We showed that individuals with Gulf War illness have about a 50% drop in mitochondrial functionality.
Really?
So this is the first time that a non-immune factor had been linked to this morbid condition that these soldiers had when they were exposed to God knows what in the Persian Gulf. We've also been involved in a number of time-restricted eating trials. We have a long-standing collaboration with Sachin Panda at the Salk, who's very interested in endurance and diet as a conduit for this. And Pam Taub, who's a cardiologist at UCSD, looking at these features. And when you're in a controlled setting and you have millions of dollars from the NIH, you can do the golden thing, right? The thing that is the gold standard for this, which is the muscle biopsy. We were involved in the NASA twin study. And so this was where the senator from Arizona and his identical twin were involved in the study. Senator stayed on ground. He was the ground control, and his identical twin went up into space for a year. And the question was, what happens to a human body when it's exposed to an environment it has never had to adapt with, right? So on planet Earth, we've had to adapt to everything except for microgravity. This is something you adapt to when you go up into space. Question was, as we're starting to build missions to the moon, colonizing the moon, going to Mars and these things, the human body is going to face a stressor it's never had to: radiation, microgravity, isolation, things like that. So could you start looking at unique elements of the human condition in this environment? One of the things that NASA was very interested in was mitochondrial functionality. They had a very keen suspicion that mitochondria decline when you're in space, but they didn't know how to really measure this other than doing biopsies and things. And again, it becomes difficult when you're in space because you've got to get samples back to Earth and all these things. So that created this opportunity to come up with a new invention and start thinking about this in a different kind of way. And so there were 10 sites picked across the U.S. UCSD was one of them. My good friend and collaborator at UCSD, Brenda Rana, was the site PI at UCSD. She knew all the crazy stuff we were doing with mitochondria in the lab. So she came to me and said, we have a challenge for your group, right? We can only give you blood plasma. Could you invent a mitochondrial test that only looks at blood plasma? So it has no cells in it, there's no mitochondria, but it has stuff, right? So the simple thought was, well, there's some tests available on the market, right? You can do these organic acid tests that test a few biomarkers that give you a potential of what the biochemistry may be. You can backbuild mitochondrial functionality. But it's the potential of something that may or may not be there, right? And so what we came up with was this idea that could we take the whole thing, right? That what that individual is creating is an environment, and it's a biochemical environment that we're capturing. It's a consequence of their genetics. It's a consequence of their mitochondria, their microbiome, their happy thoughts, their sad thoughts, their entire exposure to that environment that they're in, either on the ground or up in space and microgravity. And so now the genetics in these two guys are exactly the same. So what we're looking at is really a consequence of that environmental change that they're being exposed to. The one who's sitting on ground, who's got the ground environment, and the one sitting in space who's exposed to microgravity in that environment. So the idea we came up with is, could we build a human on a plate assay? Since we can't get access to these tissues, could we buy cells that represent different organs of the body and put them on a plate? And then to see what's happening to those organs, could we take that environment that we've captured at unique time points before flight, during flight, after flight, transfer it onto these cells and have the cells give us a readout of what that biochemistry does to their mitochondria? And so we were able to predict specific aspects of dysfunction that correlated with physiological measurements that they were doing up in space. And so we could track a specific time when muscle would dysfunction, when the immune system would dysfunction, when the endothelium would dysfunction. And it gave us this picture into what was happening into that individual from a unique perspective. This creates less of a barrier. Now you don't have to get a muscle biopsy, you just have to get a blood sample, but it's still a barrier for humans in unique ways. I mean, this had a huge barrier, right? We had to get a rocket up and bring the blood samples down. For a human, you could go to Quest, LabCorp, get a blood draw, but it still has to be processed in a unique way and shipped to the lab. And so there's this cold storage problem. So we have to overcome that. And so this is what MeScreen does. We have a card-based technology. You take you get it in the comfort of your own home. You poke your finger, a couple drops of blood onto this card. The card is a bilayer system, so it wicks the serum into the second space. Once that card dries, we've shown stability out to 6 months. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to wait 6 months to ship this to us, but if you forget about it, you can look at your mitochondrial function 6 months later. You can literally ship this to us at room temperature. Once it comes to our facility, punch the serum out, reanimate the serum in our proprietary buffer, and we essentially run a version of this NASA-type assay, right? We can look at the functionality of everything that's in there. We add it to a muscle cell that's never seen your entire environment, and we see how the mitochondria in this muscle cell start to behave as a reflection of what's likely happening inside you. And you can look at all the nitty-gritty aspects of the functional elements, the dysfunctional elements through free radical generation, and then the actual structure dynamics of the mitochondria as well when that environment is adapted on. And this biochemistry becomes a huge conduit, right? One of the things that people think about is there's this hyper-focus on DNA as the end-all and be-all of everything. Everyone is interested in their biological age. And so if you don't know what your epigenetic age is, you're not cool anymore.
Exactly.
It it's a very narcissistic focus on something that I don't think matters, right? And I'm reading this book called Transformer that Nick Lane has written, and he makes this really keen observation early on, is what's the one thing that absolutely stays the same the minute you're dead versus the minute you're alive? It's your DNA. It doesn't change, right? It's there. What absolutely changes the minute you're dead versus the minute you're alive? It's your metabolism. That's why you're dead, because your metabolism isn't working. And so if you can probe that in unique, excruciating detail, it will likely give you a really deep sense of who and what you are from a metabolic perspective. And this is what MeScreen does, is really test your entire metabolomic environment that you're creating as a consequence of everything you are and everything you're experiencing. And we can test that in fine detail in this test. And so this is where I think we really have this new vital sign that hasn't existed. And all it takes is a few drops of blood to get you access to some really deep insights into what your mitochondria are doing. Once you know where you're at, you can do a couple things with this, right? It gives you a sense of, are you doing the things you should be doing to maintain mitochondrial health? We're starting to profile unique elements out of this. We see that there's unique buckets that form of people that really are mitochondria compromised to people who are mitochondria optimized and everywhere in between. And this gives you a target of how to get from one level to the other and as you're improving your mitochondrial health. And it comes down to core features, right? Is your membrane structure intact? There's elements of this test that will allow you to see if your membrane's behaving in an optimal kind of way. The other aspect is mitophagy, autophagy, which we haven't talked about. This is one of the other reasons why old systems get old, is they lose this ability to self-digest. And so autophagy is basically self-eating. Mitophagy is basically self-eating mitochondria to then recycle. And this is a process that has to happen, right? Mitochondria get old, mitochondria get decayed. You have to be able to churn them over to get rid of that death, dying, decay. If that process stops, then you have a buildup of all of this death, dying, decay in your cells that then creates a muck-up, right? And this then doesn't support extension of biology, life, and other things. And so a lot of the second phase of therapeutics in this is to activate mitophagy and autophagy pathways. Lots of ways to do this. They don't work the same in every individual, but now you have a test to see if things are working in your favor or not. And then the final aspect of all of this, I really think, is that oxidant potential, right? You're handling oxygen at a deep level in your mitochondria, and you want to make sure that they're making energy at the end of the day, not free radicals. And so this is something that you really have to balance in a unique way as well. So that's sort of in a nutshell, things that we've come up with over the last couple of years, and really commercializing this test that gives you a unique window into your mitochondrial health.
That's exactly what I want to know about. Let's review that content again, and let's use smaller words for people like me. Oh, us older athletes, we know we're not what we were, right? You know, I don't have the endurance that I had. It takes me longer to warm up than it used to. Heck, getting back to your, how do you feel thing? I don't feel as good as I used to. Sometimes I don't feel good, hardly at all. It takes me much, much longer to recover from hard exercise, even though I will say that I'm maybe nearly as strong as I have ever been. When I use that strength and that power, it takes me much longer to get back to baseline. So anyway, I'm not what I was. And why not, right? Okay, oh, you're getting older, Joe. That's okay, Joe. That's just the way it goes. All right, well, heck with that. I want to fight back on that. And all I have is do a VO2 max test, or maybe I can check my lactate levels, in my earlobe, when I'm exercising, things like that. But I really already know that things aren't going as well. What a VO2 max is not going to test is not going to tell me. It's just going to confirm that I'm right, that I'm not as good as I was. But it's not going to tell me what part of me is breaking down. And I think you're saying your test can, right? I can have, maybe what I have is less mitochondria in my muscles than I used to. Or maybe what I have is that they're aged, they're not turning over like they should. And so maybe I have as many as I used to, but some large fraction of them don't work that well, and they don't make the energy they could. And instead, they're making more reactive oxygen species, causing other kinds of problems. maybe I don't have as many new ones because some signaling is out of whack. And, you know, when I'm exercising or whatever it is that does provide this signal, my body is like, oh, I don't hear that. I don't hear that. You know, why is that? You know, is it missing some substrate that is necessary? And I, what I'm understanding you to say, you know, just using simpler words, is that you've got a test that can sort of sort out the different reasons why my VO2 max is going down. And then you have some idea of how to deal with each of those things, depending on which one I'm suffering from versus, you know, my riding partner. And so I might have a different thing. Instead of us both just beating our head against the wall, exercising as hard as we can, I should be doing things that are going to work for whatever my dysfunction is. And he should be doing whatever it works for his dysfunction. And we can both get better, but we're getting there through different paths that are unique to us. Am I getting the picture?
Yeah, I mean, you got it dead on, right? And it's this idea that your mitochondria are personal to you, right? They're not like everyone else. And it's not just that you're at a certain age that you look like everyone else that's at your certain age. You go through a different life spectrum, right? And these create a uniquely different biochemical environment that you're adapting to. That biochemistry that your mitochondria and your cells and your environment is being bathed in is a consequence of a lot of things. It's a consequence of your genetics. It's a consequence of where you live. It's a consequence of everything that you're exposed to in your environment. And that matters, right? And this is the first test that takes all of that into account and sees how your personal environment is changing your mitochondrial biology to really give you a deep window into how to affect it long term and how to target it.
Awesome. Okay, that's really good. What would be the best would be if we had, you know, like I had taken your test and we could kind of go through it and you could say, oh, Joe, here's where your problem is and here's what you should be doing about that. But why don't you...
Well, that'll be the next podcast, right? Next time
there you go.
You take it, we'll do a reveal.
I'm going to do it. But for today, walk us through sort of like a made-up one. And what does your test score? And and for each of the areas that it is scoring, what are the kinds of things that a person would do? If they were weak in this area, they would want to do those kinds of things. And if they were strong, well, then put that aside for now. And if you're weak in this other area, then you got to do these other kind of things. Can you can do that for us?
Yeah. So this is the uniqueness and the complication of a test like this, right? And this is where I think it becomes a little hairy to commercialize this to the population, which is where our target is right now, is you can't take any one number in isolation and make a big deal about it. You have to think about all of the numbers as they fit together because they mean something up or down together, right? And so the first part of the test really looks at the functional components of your mitochondria. And the way to really do this is to measure oxygen and it's to measure extracellular acidification. This is what our system that we're using, this analytical system, does. Those two things give you a consequence of your mitochondria through the oxygen measurement, and it gives you a consequence of glycolysis through the extracellular acidification with that pH change. So we basically have this muscle cell that's kicking along on this system. We adopt your biochemistry onto that, and we see what happens from a baseline perspective of oxygen and this extracellular acidification to that cell. First thing is this tells you if your biochemistry is either turning that cell on or turning it off from a mitochondrial perspective. This becomes important, right? If you're turning it on, it suggests that there may be things that you're doing that are hyperactivating your mitochondria, which happens, right? If you're stressed, if you've been sick, if you're supplementing in an obnoxious kind of way, that's going to happen. The other aspect is if your mitochondria are depressed from a baseline perspective, this suggests that maybe you have a toxin or maybe you're super adapted and you're really putting your mitochondria to sleep when you don't need them to work. We're seeing unique profile elements of this based on that. And then the large portion of individuals, nothing happens. Their baseline doesn't change. So their biochemistry really doesn't up or down regulate those mitochondria. It stays kicking exactly where it's at. 60% of the individuals on the test have that feature, right? And then they have a very simple other changes that we see. The next part of the test then looks at the efficiency of your mitochondria. So we can add certain compounds to the system to then test if your mitochondria are behaving in an efficient or inefficient kind of way. This is the first sort of inkling of whether there may be some larger membrane dysfunction that we're seeing in the system. There's a leak. If they're not behaving properly, it gives us some ideas around that. The third part of that first test really looks at then the drive. When we make your mitochondria work, how much reserve does that system create based on your biochemistry? And so this gives us this ability to say, are you going to basically crash when we try to overstimulate your system? Or is there some gas in the tank that allows you to create that resiliency and create a drive based on this? This becomes one of these important measures. The things we see in the most hyper-adapted individuals is under baseline conditions, they have a very low baseline respiration. But then when you stress their system, they're able to create this huge window of gain of this resource and this reserve. The second part of the test basically looks at whether you're making energy under baseline conditions with mitochondrial glycolysis. This becomes really important for certain diseases that you may be dealing with, chronic kinds of things, fatigue, brain fog, things that we talked about. When you optimize one versus the other, it tells you something, right? Your system, if it's using a lot of glycolysis to make energy, it suggests that your mitochondria are shutting down or maybe compromised in a unique kind of way. If you're optimizing mitochondria, it may suggest that you're shutting this glycolysis mechanism down and your mitochondria are super optimized. And we see this in athletes and other people, right? And this that differential. Again, in most individuals, we see about an equal loading of energy from glycolysis and mitochondria. It shows that they're flexible, that they really have been optimized in one direction or the other in a good or a bad kind of way. They're just sort of kicking along, right? Then we start looking at some dysfunctional elements that start getting us into notions of what those first two sets of numbers really mean. One of the things we can look at is reactive oxygen species generation. So we've built this fluorescence-based assay that when you add your biochemical environment, we can see if under baseline conditions, these reactive species go up, and then we stress the system and make it work, and we see if that oxygen pool goes even higher. So if you're making a lot, if you're trying to churn your mitochondria in an excessive kind of way, and you make a lot of these free radicals, it suggests that you're churning your mitochondria to make free radicals and not ATP. And this could be a look at what's actually happening in your system, that you may be energy compromised because you're creating this dysfunction rather than function at the end of the way. And this is where you've got to look at the first part of the test with this third part of the test. And you don't have to do it because the algorithm does it for you, right? It looks at all of these numbers and gives you an overall mitochondrial health score that's a consequence of all this. And then the summary breaks down all of these things for you that visualizes it for you. The final component of the test, I think, is one of the most important. People think of mitochondria as the powerhouse of the cell, which is what we learned in high school. And this is probably 70% true, right? They really do make energy. But the other thing that they've adapted and learned to do is they are the consequence of life and death, right? They create this potential to either create resiliency in the system, or they say the system's tapped out and we're going to kill it, right? Apoptosis and other things that come through. And so they become a signaling entity. One of the biggest components of signaling is how well they're networked and connected together. They're an old organism, right? And so every organism has a social order and they like to be socially connected and together. If you look in most cell types that are architectured and structured, like the neuron or the cardiac myocyte, the mitochondria have this crazy pearl-like structure where one is connected to the other is connected to the other. When you have youthfulness and resiliency, you see this pearl-like connection. When you have aged, decrepit dysfunction, you see that the mitochondria become rounded and separate from each other. And this is where they become dysfunctional from the network. And so what we've done is this really sort of artful way of looking at this. And so we've created a stable cell line that expresses a green fluorescent protein only in the mitochondria. And so under our microscope, the entire mitochondrial network of this cell lights up. Now, when we adapt your biochemistry onto the cell, we can then, with our live cell video capture, we can actually see how the mitochondria are moving in real space and time. And so we've created an AI algorithm that basically gives you a network dynamic score. Are your mitochondria staying connected, or are they starting to fall apart based on the biochemistry that you're creating? And we can do this under a baseline and stress state. And so now you have this test that gives you a functional element, a dysfunctional element, and a structural dynamic element to give you this global picture of what your mitochondria do. They're not just a powerhouse. They are a signaling machine, right? And they're a dysfunctional machine, and they're a structural machine. And you give you all of those pieces as part of this test to then really give you a complete picture of what your mitochondria are doing to then start intervening with how you can fix that ultimately.
Well, what are the kinds of things that through your test people can discover? I think you talked about sort of like zone two or maybe zone one training.
I think one of the biggest things that we're seeing is that a lot of older individuals have membrane dysfunction. It's a consequence of getting old, right? Your membranes start to fall apart. And so one of the things we've been, physicians that have been using our tests have been doing is recommending lipid replacement, right? Phosphatidylcholine, serine, ethanolamine, inositol, ways to rebuild the core elements of your membrane structure to give it stability.
So do omega-3s fall into that bucket?
Sort of. I mean, eventually, yes, but I think this is what a lot of people think about. But we really need to replenish the lipids that we have in our lipid membranes that okay. then give it stability. And it's really choline, serine, ethanolamine, inositol, and these mixes of mammalian lipids that you need to rebuild.
Awesome. And so that sounds like eggs. What else? Olive oil, maybe?
There's some supplements, olive oils. There's a bunch of supplements out there on the market as well. We're starting to test a few of these out in our system to see how they work in certain individuals. I think we'll have more and more results as people start adopting this test. The test learns from individuals that take it, right? We have you give us some feedback in terms of survey. And I keep saying the magic number in this is once we hit 100, 200,000 tests, we'll be able to provide so much information to individuals because we'll take that information that individuals provide and give you aspects of, well, with this body habitus and sort of disease status and things that you're structured in dealing with, these may be the optimal things you may want to do supplement-wise that may help, right? And cut that circuit short of treatment to effect ultimately at the end.
Well, so it sounds like you're early in this process, and so you don't have like definitive answers, but anything that seems to be likely to be helpful in terms of the membranes or perhaps the signaling to the mitochondria to turn over and, you know, eat up the bad dead ones?
Yeah, so a couple things that we have been testing are lipids. And so there's a couple versions of phosphatidylcholine. There's a body bio version. Body Bio PC that has a mix of a bunch of lipids that seems to be doing well in our system.
Okay.
Urolithin A we've tested and has really cool effects on mitophagy, autophagy pathways.
That's great.
We've done studies at UCSD that look at time-restricted eating as a way to activate autophagy, mitophagy pathways. And so that seems to have really beneficial effects on mitochondrial function, but it doesn't work in everyone.
And can you define that a little more discreetly? Like, is it have to be like 12-hour window or 16-hour window? Or
yeah, so the one that we've been aggressively testing is really easy to do. It's a 10-hour eating window and a 14-hour fasting window. Okay. And that's fairly easy to do. And you again, I'll ask people if they're intermittent fasting, and they'll say, oh, yeah, I am. And then I ask them what their window is. Well, you know, some days I start at 10. I'm like, then you're not intermittent fasting. You got to pick the same window every day. And so this is the hard part is people think they're doing these things. And we get this a lot, right? Our algorithm will give you some suggestions of things that you could possibly do supplement-wise and those kinds of things. And a lot of people will be like, well, I'm doing all these things. And then when you start picking at it, you realize that they're sort of half-assing everything, right? They're not really doing what they say they're doing. And so it's really got to be a concerted way of targeting these things.
Right. Well, and when you're trying to do 100 things, you know, how can you be consistent with 100 Hard. Things? So you got to pick the most important ones. I agree. And it sounds like your test helps you to prioritize better so that you can save money on all the things you aren't really helping you because you don't need help there. And then focus on the things you do need.
Yeah, and one of the things that we see is people want to do a lot of things, right? They think that if their mitochondria are horrible, you got to do all the things at the same time. And it's a leveled, structured approach. If your membranes are dysfunctional, you can try to fix your ROS and you can try to fix your autophagy, mitophagy. It's not going to work until you get your membranes in order, right? So you got to start with the foundation and then build to the next level and the next level. And okay. This is something that I think takes education to get people to think critically about.
Okay, well, good. And you have talked about how, you know, how the biohackers who are always whacking their mitochondria are overdoing it, and the mitochondria are breaking down because they never get a rest. So we don't want to do too much, but maybe there's more than just exercise. You know, exercise and diet and sleep, I guess, are the big things. But maybe there are some other things, like maybe sauna, I've heard, is good. And I don't know if cold exposure is good. Anything like that?
Yeah, we're in the process of testing some of these things out. So a lot of the companies that have these products are starting to use MeScreen as a way to validate, right?
Oh, great.
That what they say actually does what it does. And so we'll do clinical trials with them or studies with them where we'll have subjects get a pre-test and they'll do their intervention for a certain number of time. And then we'll do a post-test and see if there's a change in their mitochondrial functionality pre to post. And then essentially validate that procedure out for them. So totally doable.
That sounds really good. I look forward to hearing more about that. I guess my last question would be about protein. You know, we hear so many things. You know, you want to protein restrict so you can live forever.
Yeah.
Or you want to have extra protein, especially when you get older, because, you know, your anabolic resistance is, you know, you're going to be sarcopenic. Have you, like, studied any of this effect, you know, protein on the mitochondria?
We haven't. I mean, this is something that I think it needs to be done. And we're starting to work with people like Sachin, who are very interested in human endurance and looking at diet as a conduit to this. Could you do a protein versus a fat-rich diet? And could you alter this in a time-restricted manner to get unique changes in biology? And I think it's about not only what you eat, but the timing of which you eat it, right? That becomes really important. Because our bodies will turn that food into a different source of fuel if you do it the right way. So,
right. Well, circadian rhythm is important. There's no doubt. Yeah. And if you eat the same diet when your body is wanting to sleep, you know, it's like things are going cross purposes.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Okay, Dr. Patel, hey, you've been generous with your time. So let's wrap it up here. What can you tell our audience in terms of how to find more information about this? You know, this test and you know, anything else that you would want to point them at to learn more about how to make their mitochondria better?
Yeah, you can go to MeScreen.com. We can generate a discount code for you as well.
Great. And MeScreen, that's MeScreen.com,
yep.
Okay.
And then if you want to keep in touch with stuff that we're thinking about mitochondria and all the other stuff that goes on in my lab, you can just follow me at Instagram. It's Hemal Patel, PhD. And it gives you access to all kinds of mitochondrial things that we talk about and think about, as well as all the other stuff that we're working on.
Yeah, I'll put those in the notes. And everybody who's been driving while they're listening, they can find all that stuff there. Dr. Patel, thank you very much. This has been really great.
Yeah, it's great.
All right. Have a great night.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Dr. Hemal Patel. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find more information about Dr. Patel and the MeScreen in the show notes.